welcome aboard the battleship Pretension. I am David Bax. Tyler is still out of commission. If you want to know what's going on with Tyler, I would recommend going to caringbridge.org/visit/Tyler and Jennifer Smith. Again, that's caringbridge.org/visit/Tyler and Jennifer Smith. That's where you can get updates. You can also find at the top of the homepage of battleshippretension.com, you can find a link to the GoFundMe. That's where you can help Tyler's family out with their mounting medical costs as this thing stretches on into nearly half a year at this point. So again, check that out. It's just me this week, so I don't know if I have a top of the show type of pre-topic to do. If you want to hear our thoughts on the Oscar nomination, me and Scott, nominations, me and Scott, you can subscribe to the Patreon, patreon.com/battleshippretention. We went through all the categories, minus the shorts. We went through all the categories and talked about what we were surprised about and what the Academy might have been thinking and what kind of show it might be and stuff like that. So, check out the Patreon. That's how I'm going to start the episode, is by doing a plug for the Patreon. Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you about TweakedAudio.com. TweakedAudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. I use them each and every day. Tyler, I don't know, because he's in a new facility now. He might be using them. He wasn't using them in his old facility because he had a private room and didn't need earbuds. pardon me. they look great. They sound great. I use them each every day. Today, continuing with the best metal albums of 2022, I listened to an album. Well, the band is S-A-O-R. Sour, maybe? I'm not sure how you pronounce it. And the album is called Origins. And, it's a black metal, folk black metal band. I'm trying to they're from the UK, and the album's great, especially to listen to all at once. I listened to it on my earbuds while I was on a walk early this morning, and it's a great experience to listen to all at once as a complete album, and it sounded great on my tweakedaudio.com earbuds. Those are available at a low price at tweakedaudio.com, but if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well, inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, I'm back from the break, but I'm also back from Park City. Back from Utah for the first time since the early days of 2020 the world-changing pandemic was closing in on us, and we didn't even quite know it yet. So it was great to get back to Park City. I'm very lucky to be able to do that. This is my sixth in-person Sundance. It's really a great time up on the mountain in the snow. I would say overall this year's slate was, maybe I just made bad selections. It wasn't as great. There were a couple real winners, but and a couple of real stinkers, but maybe more than a couple of real stinkers, but most of it, it was just a sort of like down the middle type of like, yeah, some interesting movies, but not overly interesting. I'm going to start with one that I didn't love. It's a documentary directed by Ido Mizrahi, called The Longest Goodbye. And this is a documentary about space travel, specifically about the psychology of space travel. There's interviews with NASA sort of official psychologist, and a look at, you know, studies that have been done on people, you know, living in confinement for a long period of time. Some anonymous studies that have been done of past astronauts, but also a lot of past astronauts being resistant to being analyzed in this kind of way. It was interesting in the sense that I learned a lot, but it really didn't feel like, it felt more like a TV special than a movie. You know, it feels like I got some good tidbits that I could like bring up if space travel comes up in a conversation at some point down the line, but it didn't really move me. The next documentary, which I thought was going to be a little bit more like cutesy, and it is, but also I did kind of find it moving, it's called Kim's Video. It's directed by David Redman and Ashley Sabin. And it is about the New York chain of video stores, Kim's Video, that closed in the early 2000s. But it's not, and it has some of that, like, remember when this sort of thing existed, this like weird video store that had all these rare tapes and bootlegs and stuff, and people like Robert Greene and Alex Ross Perry like worked there as clerks at some point. And it has some of that, but David Redman, of the two directors, he is the one who is operating the camera, and is the narrator of the movie. He did not work at the video store, but he was a member who rented there and sort of seems to have become obsessed with the collection and where did this collection of 55,000 tapes and DVDs end up, you know, who has access to it, that sort of thing. And so it's a really fascinating story that leads him to multiple other countries trying to track down this collection. It gets him into some trouble with the law at one point. It's a very fun story, but also we are learning more about Mr. Kim. Youngman Kim, and his own cinematic obsessions. And so you see this obsession, this drive, this fixation on movies in general, rare movies in general, and these movies, these physical like tapes and DVDs and stuff, particularly, overlap between the director and Mr. Kim. And so the movie ends up being, it's like a fun story that it's actually like a really good story. But it's also a look at the way that art, be it the creation of art or the collection of art, or the enjoyment of art, helps people focus or process or sublimate their neuroses, maybe is the word I'm looking for. So the movie's like fun and funny and it's a great story, but it's also way more thoughtful and provoking than I expected it to be. All right, next up, a film called The Eight Mountains. I've got three in a row here that are all in the spotlight section at Sundance. And what that means is Sundance is a film festival, you know, it's a premier film festival, in more ways than one. And I mean, literally in that almost every movie that plays there is a premiere. It's premiering at Sundance because it's a prestigious festival and that's what people want. But they also do reserve a small section of the programming for movies that made a big impression on their programmers at other festivals over the course of the past year that haven't yet come out in the U.S. So I've got three in a row that are part of the spotlight section. So The Eight Mountains is one of them. It's also, it's 2.5 hours long, which is not normal for Sundance. Sundance movies tend to be on the shorter side. But you got to get through all eight mountains, you know. Directed by Felix Van Groningen, who directed The Broken Circle Breakdown, which is great and like pretty high on the list of it pretty high in the running for the title of saddest movie I've ever seen. Then he made one called Belgica or Belgica, which I haven't seen. Then he made his American movie Beautiful Boy, which is not very good. But The Eight Mountains sees him teaming up for the first time with Charlotte Vandermeer, who wrote or co-wrote Broken Circle Breakdown, and has, I think, appeared in his movies, but this is her first time as a director, and they're a directing team. So this is a movie about, like I said, it's about 2.5 hours. No, it's about, it starts in the 80s where a boy from the city, it's an Italian movie, boy from Turin, his family vacations in this small mountain town for the entire summer, and he becomes friends with a local like farmer boy, and then they end up going back every summer for the rest of his childhood, and they become close friends, and then they grow apart, and they end up coming back together as adults in their, you know, I don't know, late 30s, early 40s, I guess probably late 30s, and starting this project of fixing up an old house together. But that's what, I mean, what I've described is, like, takes you, like, even the fixing up the house takes you only up to about the halfway point of the movie. There's a whole, the movie expands after that. But it's another, not to the extent of Broken Circle Breakdown, but it is another movie that is very sad, but not in the maudlin way of Beautiful Boy. It's well-earned and human because I think Van Groningen and Vandermeer, is that her name? Vandermeer. They love these two. They love the other people in their lives, and they are invested in this friendship, but I think the movie is about the sort of inevitable fact that some things just don't last, no matter how much of yourself you put into them and how much they mean to you. Sometimes things run their course and there's nothing you can do about it, and that's a source of great pain. I know... I can't wait to talk to Tyler about this movie because I know he has often, or at least has occasionally, complained that there aren't enough movies about male friendship, that just close male friendship, intimate male friendship that is not romantic or sexual. And The Eight Mountains might be one of the better movies I've ever seen on that subject. So, well done to Van Groningen and Vandermeer. Next up is the first one I've ever seen from Rebecca Zlotowski. She's known for Planetarium, and I think Grand Central is also one of hers that I've heard of. With Léa Seydoux? Yeah, that is her. But her new film was called Other People's Children, and it is about a woman played by Virginie Efira from Paul Verhoeven's Benedetta, who is a teacher who is herself childless and dating, and then you know, starts a relationship with a man who is divorced and has a 4-year-old child, and they become close, and she becomes a stepmother sort of, and she starts to, she starts to like acknowledge that if she wants to have a biological child of her own, it's going to have to happen probably sooner than later. So it has, I mean, that all sounds melodramatic, and I guess this is a melodrama, but as we've often said, you know, so many people use melodrama in a negative way, but something like Other People's Children can really, really proves just how strong, deeply emotional, that sort of format can be. So in an interesting way, Other People's Children reminded me of The Worst Person in the World, even though, you know, this woman is almost 20 years older than the character in Worst Person in the World, and the movie is, you know, French, but in the sense, not just that both movies are beautifully shot, beautifully composed, but in the sense that it's a very personal, or it's a story about a single person that only gradually reveals itself to actually be about life as we know and live it in the world that we inhabit, and the effect we have on each other and the decisions we make for ourselves and for the people we care about. I found myself really bowled over by the end of the movie. One second. Okay, excuse me. Next up is a movie called La Immensita, L apostrophe Immensita, directed by Emmanuel Crialese, and starring Penelope Cruz, which is really the main thing that you want to know about it. But unfortunately, it's just not very good. Even with Penelope Cruz, who is someone that I love, I just thought the movie was, well, you know what? I was talking about melodrama being used as a bad term. This seems like a, it's a bad melodrama. It's mostly about, it takes place in the 1970s, and, Penelope Cruz plays the mother to a group of children, but the oldest child, Adri or whatever, is, weren't using the term then, but is clearly a trans boy. But the world doesn't understand that. And her father, certainly played by Vincenzo Amato, certainly doesn't understand that. The trans boys play Luana Giuliani. But I got annoyed with how much the movie is looking for a pat on the back, and flattering the audience in terms of us like feeling sympathy for this trans boy in a time, not that things are like easy for trans kids now, God, not even close, but at a time when there wasn't even a word for that. But it makes him like a little too perfect, you know. It has him sort of like shouting at men for catcalling and stuff, and it just feels it feels so clearly written in the modern, from a modern day point of view, that it was hard to see any of the characters as real people, as opposed to just like projections of someone who is in the 2020s trying to make a point. Unfortunately, can't speak too highly of Lemoncita. Next up is Savannah Leaf's Earth Mama, which is a movie about a young woman who is pregnant, and at the same time as her two already existing kids have been taken out of her care and placed in foster care. She gets to visit them for short supervised visits once a week or so, and she's in the process of trying to get them back. Tia Nomore is the name of the actress, who's actually a rapper, and she's absolutely the main reason to see this movie. It's a fantastic, captivating performance. And the movie, without being thesis driven or lecturing, is a pretty powerful sort of delineation of the way that being on the skids financially means all of your problems get worse. And once you're in a system like your kids are in the foster care system, there's no getting out, and it's a trap that is seemingly designed for one thing, but actually seems to function in such a way as to make things worse and make it harder and harder to grow and to reunite and everything. So it's a really powerful movie in that sense. It also has some sort of like flights of inspiration, whatever, where things happen that are clearly like in Tina Mori's character's head. What is her name? The character's name is Gia, I think. Yeah, Gia. In her head, and those become sort of like real for a moment. And those moments seem a little like tacked on to like, as if Savannah Leaf felt like, well, this needs to be more, you know, impressionistic or more surreal or more arty, I guess. I didn't love those, but it's still definitely a fascinating movie and a fantastic performance from Tia Nomore. One second. That's the problem with doing these solo, is there's no one to vamp when I have to take a drink of water. But you don't want me to not be taking drinks of water. Okay, so let's move on to the first real piece of, I guess you could accuse me of contrarianism here. Because Chloe Domont's Fair Play made quite a splash, and I did not care for it. I really like Phoebe Dynevor from Bridgerton. She played Lady Daphne, if you know Bridgerton. And I like Alden Ehrenreich, who hasn't been in a movie in like 5 years. This is a movie about there are two analysts at a financial, I don't know. I'm already bored is the thing. This is like, so much of this takes place in the like high stakes world of finance, but it's like all bullshit and I don't care and it's super boring. But it's all these people care about. So it was really hard to me to get into the movie when they're talking about like, I'm going to short this and there's a prospect of the fucking, like, I don't care about finance stuff. And that's, like I said, that's all they care about. The characters are boring because the only thing they care about is something that is like mind-numbingly boring. Those two actors that I mentioned play a couple who work for the same firm, but they are not like they're not supposed to be dating according to the rules of the company. So they keep it secret, but then Phoebe Dynevor's character gets promoted and is the boss of the of Alden Ehrenreich's character, and he can't handle that. And so the characters are always already so thin to begin with. Like, we know they say they love each other, although we see very little like evidence of it before they really like before Alden Ehrenreich's character just starts fucking things up for everybody because he can't handle it. But we basically just know that they care about their jobs, and that's it. So they're already thinly drawn characters, and on top of that, then Alden Ehrenreich's character becomes an allegory for like men who are intimidated by powerful women or women who outrank them in their status. And so it's interesting. There's another movie coming up that I went into Sundance thinking could had the potential to be, you know, this year's Promising Young Woman, which, as you'll recall, I did not care for Promising Young Woman at all. But weirdly, this one, which is being talked about more, is like, oh, it's a throwback to 90s erotic thrillers. It's, other than one, like very charming scene at the very beginning, there's not really much that's erotic about the movie at all. And it seems more like a thesis statement. So maybe that's why the next movie I saw I loved so much. You know, maybe it helped that I had just come from a movie I didn't like very much to go see, excuse me, Celine Song's Past Lives, in which the actress Greta Lee, who I really like, plays a Korean-born woman who left Korea with her family in, I guess, the early 90s. I'm trying to remember exactly when it is. Or maybe the late 90s, now that I think about it. Yeah, probably late 90s, early 2000s. Anyway, that's not important. I'm just doing the math in my head. They immigrated to Canada, and eventually in the modern day, she lives in New York City. She is working as a writer and is married to another writer, a white American man played by John Magaro. But then her childhood best friend slash crush, Hae-sung, played by UTO, comes to visit the city. And so, yeah, to have it explained like that, it's it makes it sound like a love triangle type of story, which I guess on the surface that is how you could describe it as a hook. But the movie is called, like I said, it's called Past Lives, and it's really about the way that we change, but the people that we were remain with the people who knew us when we were those people. So it's kind of ephemeral and ethereal and there's another word I had on my existential. I'm using all these E words. And there's a deep sense of, there's a deeply bittersweet sense to the, like, someone like Greta Lee's character can hold, and any human being can hold in their mind at the same time being happy with their lives as they are and also longing in some way for what could have been differently. Those things seem competing, but holding competing ideas in your head is a big part of being human, and Past Lives is easily the best premiere I saw at the festival, and moved me into, it did not quite move me to tears, but I was apparently in the minority in that, as the credits rolled, there was just a chorus of sniffling all around me at the Eccles Theater. Definitely don't miss Past Lives when it comes out. That's my recommendation. Do give a pass, unfortunately, to Elijah Bynum's magazine Dreams, in which Jonathan Majors, who's a very talented actor, and this movie seems almost designed to prove how talented he is, plays an aspiring bodybuilder who lives and takes care of his grandfather, but is also clearly in some need of taking care of himself, has some psychological, maybe developmental issues, and his path towards bodybuilding is his entire purpose, and anytime anything throws that off, he goes into a very dark existential tailspin, and it just felt like it was reveling in a cynical vision of the world. It felt exploitative of our ills, as opposed to like delving into them or exploring them. It felt like it was exploiting our societal ills of the way that people on the fringe are treated, and those most at risk are, of course, also those most taken advantage of, and you know, how people become violent or become incels or whatever. But it wasn't, there's nothing interesting, and it goes on forever, and it's just wallowing, dark, cynical, exploitative garbage. It reminded me a lot of The Whale. All right. So the movie I mentioned earlier that I thought might be, had the potential, excuse me real quick, had the potential to be a superficial movie like Promising Young Woman is Susanna Fogel's Cat Person, which I enjoyed. I had really liked the short story that was written by someone. Someone wrote it. Kristen Rupenian, I think would be her name, wrote a short story called Cat Person. Yeah, that's a short story, and this is a full 2-hour movie. It does expand upon the story. It expands upon it in the sense that it adds some color to, you know, if you didn't read Cat Person, by the way, I should say, Emilia Jones stars in it, and she's the lead, Margot, who is a college student who has a part-time job in a movie theater, and then starts a relationship with a older man in his 30s who's kind of not quite like Jonathan Majors in Magazine Dreams, but is kind of a stunted nerd himself. Anyway, so yeah, the movie adds some details to the story as it exists. You know, we meet like Margot's parents or mom and stepdad, but then it also, if you've read the short story, it ends in a way that is more suggestive than actually conclusive. And so in true like movie fashion, an entire like third act of the movie, if not like second half of the movie, is completely invented. That sounds like I'm making fun, but I actually do think the inventions of the movie, while being more, you know, audience pleasingly dramatic and movie-ish, I think do still stick to the thing that's so interesting about this short story, the thing that got so many people talking about the short story has got people talking. that there's a, it's clearly like a post Me Too type of story, about the way that men, again, you know, men like Justin Long. Here you've got, what's his name? Nicholas Braun. Again, kind of unassuming, like, nice guy type. By the way, if that Justin Long thing was a reference to the movie journal. If you didn't listen to the last movie journal, go check that out. Sorry. Now I've lost track. What was I saying? Okay, so yeah, this story about how, like, the dangers that lurk inside the hearts and minds of men who feel they haven't gotten, aren't getting what they deserve. But the thing that's so fascinating about Cat Person, the short story that I think the movie does a good job of retaining, is that it's not that simple. Like, on the one hand, yeah, the cat person, Robert is the character's name, he does reveal himself to be an angry, cool, like, bad dude. But the movie and the short story acknowledge that humanity in an individual are not as simple as good or bad. There's you know, I'm trying to remember, Margot hurts him, and that doesn't justify the way that he reacts. But it's also true that she hurt him in ways that she didn't necessarily have to. Her own immaturity is not flattering. This isn't a story like La Mencita, where the good guy is wholly good, you know, all the time. And I like how flawed Margot is, and how much the movie recognizes that there are a lot of, there's a lot of gray on the spectrum between good and bad. It managed to do that without, like, giving Robert, or a viewer who's like Robert, a way out or a moral off-ramp, or letting him off the hook. So yeah, it's not like a revelation, it's not perfect, but I would say that adapting that short story into a movie offered up some risks, and Susanna Fogel's movie stepped around those. It walked over the risks. It didn't trip the wires. Yeah, decently done. Now, this could be one of those things, this movie might end up being a flashpoint, and I'll get annoyed by the discourse, but right now I'm in the point of, like, I just saw it, and it wasn't bad, and I will probably mostly forget about it pretty soon, but unless it becomes a big deal of a movie. Okay, one second. Continuing on to a movie that is already out in theaters, actually, but premiered at Sundance, Brandon Cronenberg's Infinity Pool. And I am very pro Brandon Cronenberg. I haven't seen Antiviral, but I loved Possessor. And Infinity Pool isn't quite, I don't think, as intoxicating and entrancing and as Possessor, though it might be as disgusting as Possessor at sometimes. It weirdly fits into this this eat the rich mentality, or, like, look at how fucked up the rich people are thing that has really dominated a lot of movies, especially in the this past year, with things like Triangle of Sadness and Glass Onion and I guess The Menu. I haven't seen it. I also haven't watched White Lotus, but it just seems like there's a real resurgence in that kind of mentality, and Infinity Pool definitely fits into that. Alexander Skarsgård and Cleopatra Coleman play a couple who were vacationing in a fictional country at a very fancy resort. They meet another couple played by Mia Goth and Jaleel Lesper. I don't know him, but he's very good in the movie, by the way. Yeah. Anyway, they befriend them, they get into some trouble with the law, and they, I don't want to give too much away, but they find out about the very specific way that this fictional country deals with wealthy criminals. And the movie digs into, or I would say on the surface, doesn't dig into it. On the surface, it is about the way that the rules work differently for rich people, and rich people can get away with things. But also, Brandon Cronenberg has a preoccupation with questions of identity, and the separation between identity and the, bleeding, punctured, malleable, soft, breakable, flesh in which the identity is housed. And so the movie ends up being more of a descent into Alexander Skarsgård's disassociation and his back and forth between the freedom of immorality and the loss of self, of giving in to your own worst impulses. The movie is dreamy, maybe more nightmarish than dreamy, but sometimes quite dreamy as well. Incredibly, incredibly gory. And Mia Goth continues to be on quite a run just with these. This character is hilarious, but also scary. And also, as she often is, she's quite sexy. It's a movie full of really great performances in service of something that is not quite like anything you've seen before. So I applaud Brandon Cronenberg and definitely urge you, if you have the stomach for it, to check out Infinity Pool. Don't learn much more about it than I told you before you're going to see it. Weirdly, I could also say about something that's a much more low-key movie, I would also say maybe don't learn too much about the movie before you're going to see it. Alice Englert, who's an actor, wrote and directed a movie called Bad Behavior, in which Jennifer Connelly plays a former child actor who is going off to a sort of silent, meditative, new agey, like self-confrontational retreat to try and find herself. We come to realize this is something she has been doing a lot. This is not her first time going to one of these type of things. She's searching for something. Meanwhile, her daughter, played by Alice Englert, actually has become a professional stuntwoman and is on a shoot in New Zealand. And the movie sort of cuts back and forth between the Pacific Northwest in New Zealand, and sort of draws parallels between this mother and daughter and what they've done with their lives and how they've gotten there. But Jennifer Connelly is definitely the main star, and she's fantastic. She's playing a woman who is completely completely out of touch with herself, and as we come to realize, has probably not been in touch with herself or the real world for a long, long time, and is going through a very protracted and serious bout of psychological distress, depression, and other sorts of things. But the movie is also darkly very funny. But this, I won't say too much more about what happens in the movie, but I will say that Jennifer Connelly gives what I think might be the performance of her career. There's also, I know this is a controversial figure, but I tend to like her when she's in movies. Dasha Nekrasova, who's, you know, from The Scary of 61st and from real life stuff that I don't give a fuck about. She's another person who's at the retreat who's like a, she plays a model, which is very like good for her persona to play. Anyway, yeah, so Bad Behavior, liked it quite a bit. Next up, a documentary called Kokomo City. Kokomo City is not a real place. I'm not sure exactly what it means, but this is a look at black trans women, specifically black trans women who have learned to survive through sex work. And that feels specific, but one of the things that's so fascinating about the movie is realizing, like, unfortunately, how common this is because of the lack of options and the amount of rejection from friends and family. Trans women and black trans women go through that, so many of them turn to sex work. But what's also so fascinating about the movie is that it's an overview of so many different kinds of humanity. It's an argument that, you know, black trans women is not, there's not just, it's not a one size fits all. Like, there are so many different things that any black trans woman, just like any black cis woman or any other person can be. And yet there are also at the same time a lot of things that bind them together that are very specific to their experience. But what I'm saying makes it sound like it's a didactic, that it's a lesson, it's a survey. Really, the thing that comes through is the shocking amount of positivity these women have, despite what they've gone through. The personality, the movie feels like a fun, like, hangout after party in so many ways, even though sometimes it's very sobering. But it's more often than not joyous, almost celebratory. I was really, really into it. I really started to feel quite a connection to these women over the course of the movie. It's very short, and I wish I could spend more time with these women. Okay, next up, this is the penultimate. We're almost at the end here. New film from Justin Chon, called Jamojaya. I haven't seen Ms. Purple, but I'm a fan of Justin Chon. I liked his debut, which is called Gook. I loved Blue Bayou. I also watched Apple TV Plus's Pachinko, which he directed half the episodes of. I really like him, and Jamojaya is generally no exception, but you know, with a caveat that we'll come back to. The movie is about a young Indonesian rapper who has a record deal with an American label and has come to Hawaii to record his debut album, and then unannounced, his father, who, when he was just a local, just a rapper in Indonesia, his father was his manager, but he kind of like had to part ways on business terms with his father to try and reach a bigger audience, and his father comes to Hawaii unannounced, and that's kind of the germ here of the action. Hold on. But if you know Justin Chon, I'm going to come back to a word I keep using this episode, and that's melodrama. And Justin John, I think, is one of current cinema's most undersung and talented melodramatists. The depth of emotion that is felt in the history and the liminal space between this father and son, but also the resentment because there's a brother who died, in a way we'll find out, you find out later in the movie. There's an absence there. The mother is not there. This father and son are all each other have, but also they represent to one another what they don't have and what they've lost. So there's a lot of angst, I guess, there. But one thing I've really liked about Justin Chan is his eye and his use of color, or in the case of something like Gook, which is in black and white, his lack of use of color, but that's just as deliberate and powerful. And here you've got this movie that is so rich and brilliant in color. I mean, we're in the verdant Hawaiian, you know, jungle, and then the sandy beaches and the blue ocean, but also J-Mo is the main character's name, the rapper. His indoor life of studios and corporate parties and stuff and promotional appearances is based in these reds and yellows, and sometimes greens and blues. It's a gorgeous movie. The cinematographer's name is Ante Chang, who is clearly, I mean, Blue Bayou, Gook, Ms. Purple, Jim Ojaya, like, clearly these two are a package deal, Justin Chan and Ante Chang. So I really found the movie very touching, but let's get back to that enormous caveat. And I know that, hold on, sometimes movies, you know, they play festivals and then they get changed before they come out. I kind of hope that is the case here, because there was a big emotional moment near the end of Jam Ojaya that Justin Chan, for some reason that I cannot fathom, chose to score or to backdrop with the song Strange Fruit by Billie Holiday. This is not a movie about lynching. It's not a movie about Black Americans. There is plenty of talk of trees and fruit, and so I kind of like halfway understand why Justin Chan might have thought of this song, but he's got to know what the song is about. And it's so weird to use this song in this moment when the song has so much meaning and cultural weight attached to it. It's super fucking weird and jarring, and it took me right out of the movie. And I truly hope that someone gets in Justin Chan's ear and gets him to put another song in that scene before the movie actually comes out. Because it's, frankly, it's fucking insane that he chose to put that song in there. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Anyway, let's move on to the final movie that I saw, which is the new movie from Nicole Holof Center. And it's a reunion between her and Julie Louis-Dreyfus from Enough Said, which is 10 years old now. It's called You Hurt My Feelings. Julie Louis-Dreyfus plays a writer whose husband, played by Tobias Menzies, is a therapist. The sort of narrative and character arc-y sort of crux of the movie is that he's very supportive of her new novel to her, but she overhears him talking to one of his friends about how he doesn't like the new book and he doesn't know he can't tell her that, and it sends her into a kind of a tailspin. You know, that's the incident of the movie, but I think Nicole Hall of Sinners' sense of community, I mean, it's a very specific, you know, upper middle class New York City community. Michaela Watkins plays Julia Louis-Dreyfus's younger sister. Jeannie Berlin plays their mother. There are a bunch of great small roles playing Tobias Menzies' patients. And Owen Teague plays their son, who also wants to be a writer himself. And so I think the Nicole Hall of Sinners is very good at the sort of connections of community, the specific that is also universal. I mean, I think this is a movie that is very much, or is mostly for people who are like this, but I also think the sense of community that is drawn in the movie would make this movie illuminating in a positive way to people who aren't from this type of world. So yeah, there's friendships and relationships, and, you know, like the great sort of American indie filmmaker that Nicole Hall of Sinners is. That's their bread and butter. That those types of filmmakers, you know, not remnants, because she's still obviously thriving, but people who have the roots in the 90s American independent movement. She's just one of the ones that's still going strong. And I'm putting saving the best for last, which is that the movie is hilarious. It's so funny, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus is so great. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine anyone not being a fan of Julia Louis-Dreyfus, but for those who are especially big JLD fans, this movie is her in top form. So definitely highly recommended that you check out You Hurt My Feelings when it came out. And I have no voice left, but I have no voice, but I must wrap up. Those are the movies that I saw at Sundance. I'll be posting reviews at battleshipretention.com. Otherwise, you can find my tweets about the movies at Davey Pretension on Twitter. Reach out to me there. Email me at david@battleshipretention.com. Check out my other podcast, The One Where I Met Your Mother, where my wife and I watch an episode of Friends and an episode of How I Met Your Mother every week. This most recent episode that we just recorded that we most recently posted is season 4, episode 13 of both shows, which means it's for How I Met Your Mother, it's the episode 3 Days of Snow, which is one of, if not the all-time favorite for me of that series. So that's a good episode. So check that out. You can find it at battleshipretention.com, wherever you want. Thanks for listening, and we will get you next time.